Despite decades of consistent warning from the scientific community, the American public remains divided on the issue of climate change. This week's guest says there are six Americas in the climate debate, and you can't communicate with each one in the same way. He's Yale University's Anthony Leiserwitz, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island, alongside my friend and colleague G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week we explore the stories that shape America's public life, and this week we're joined by Anthony Leiserwitz, director of the Yale University Program on Climate Change Communication and host of Climate Connections, a nationally syndicated radio program and podcast. Tony, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thank you so much for the invitation to be here.
So the scientific community keeps warning us, and has been warning us for some time, that there's something going on with the Earth's climate and we need to do something about it.
Yeah.
How does the American public process that message?
Well, it's a complex message, and so in lots of different ways. It turns out there's not a single public. I think that's actually one of the most important things we can start with, is that Americans don't have a single viewpoint about climate change or, frankly, any other major important issue that we deal with. And so some people will then divide the public into believers and deniers. But that's actually too simplistic as well, and it actually does a lot of violence to what's really going on out there in the real world. And in our research, we've identified what we call global warming six Americas, six different parts of the public that each respond to this issue in very different ways. And, you know, as an effective communicator, you have to recognize that people have different starting points, they have different understandings of the issue, they have different values, they trust different sources, and so on. And if you want to communicate effectively, you need to reach people where they are, not necessarily where you are. So the Six Americas construct really does help us understand
that. So let's walk through that Six Americas. You identify the alarmed, which in November of 2016 made up 16% of the electorate.
Actually, 18%.
18%.
That's right.
So who are they? What do they believe?
So the alarmed are people who are firmly convinced that climate change is happening, human-caused, a very serious problem. They're very worried about it. They strongly support policy action. However, many of them don't yet know what we can do about it. They don't know what they as individuals can do or what we collectively as a society can do. So they're very engaged with the issue, but they haven't really taken it necessarily to that next step of taking action.
So the second group of the six you call the concerned.
Yes.
And the figure I have is 34%
That's
of
correct.
The electorate.
Yes.
So talk to us about the concerned. Who are they and what do they believe?
Yeah, so the concerned is the single largest group in the country. They think that climate change is happening and that it's human caused, and they do think it's serious. But they tend to think of it as distant in time, that the impacts won't be felt for a generation or more, and distant in space, that this is about polar bears or maybe some developing countries, but not the United States, not Rhode Island, not Newport or Providence, not my friends and family or any of the people and places I care about. So as a result, it's psychologically distant. It's one of those many, many issues that are out there that, yeah, I kind of wish somebody would do something about, but doesn't necessarily seem to connect to my life and my values, and thus needs to be an urgent priority.
So the next group is the cautious at 23%?
That's correct. So the cautious is another pretty large chunk. That is people who are kind of still on the fence. Is it real? Is it not? Is it human? Is it natural? Is it a serious problem, or is it kind of overblown? They're paying attention, but just really haven't made up their mind yet. They tend to be confused by the discourse they see.
Okay. I love this, by the way. Number four is the disengaged, and that's the smallest percentage, and I have 5%.
5%, but a really important community. These are people who say, you know, I think I once heard the term global warming, but I don't know anything about it. I don't know what the causes are. I don't know what the consequences are. You know, I don't know what we do about it. I just don't think about it very much. And so for them, it's really basic awareness that's the primary barrier that's keeping them from becoming more engaged.
If you think about this from sort of political perspective, are they gettable?
they're very gettable. I mean, they tend to be, I mean, it's not a perfect connection here, but they're like the low information voter.
Okay.
There's this set of voters out there who will, on occasion, show up at especially national elections, but they just don't pay any attention to political news.
Because I went back and I looked at your original data from 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
And that number was higher, if I'm remembering it correctly.
That's right.
Any idea why that's come down over time?
That, I think, is just part of the maturation of the issue. I mean, the more that we talk about this, the more that we engage with this as a society, that number should get smaller and smaller.
Number five, the doubtful.
The doubtful, that's about 11% of the country. These are people who think, you know, I don't think global warming is real, but if it is, it's natural. Nothing that humans have anything to do with, therefore nothing we can really do much about. I don't think about it very much, but if, you know, to the extent I do, I don't see it as much of a risk. So they're predisposed to say not a problem.
And then the final group is the dismissive at about 9%.
That's right. And so the dismissives are firmly convinced that this is not real. This is not human caused. This is not a serious problem. And in fact, many of them just quite willingly tell us that they're conspiracy theorists. They say it's a hoax. It's scientists making up data. It's a UN plot to take away American sovereignty. It's a get-rich scheme by Al Gore and his friends, and many, many other such kind of conspiracy-oriented narratives. I think importantly to say, however, is that that's 9% of the country.
Yeah.
It's only 9% of the country. But there are really loud 9%. There are really vocal 9%. There are 9% that's very well represented in the halls of Congress. And so they've had a far larger influence on our public discourse and our public debate on the issue than perhaps their proportion warrants.
So armed with this sort of this breakdown of what the American public believes in these segments, as a communicator, what do these groupings tell you?
So they tell me several different things. In fact, we ask Americans, I'll just use this as an example, what's the one thing you would ask an expert on climate change if you had the opportunity? So that doubtful and dismissive group, and this is really to make the point, there are three completely different conversations happening in this country at the same time. The doubtful and dismissive, their primary question is, so how do you know that global warming's real or human caused? And on a deeper level, they're really asking, why should I trust you? Okay. Huh. The middle groups are saying, okay, maybe it's real. But so what? Why should I care? What's it got to do with me? And then the alarmed and concerned are basically saying, yeah, I got it. It's happening. It's human caused. It's serious. But what do we do about it? Okay. What are the solutions? Okay. Those are three very different kinds of conversations that are all happening in the same country and, frankly, often in the same family around the same dinner table at the same time.
So is there any chance or opportunity or even desire to bring these, we'll take the two extremes, we'll take the dismissive and we'll take the alarmed, to bring them to some kind of common ground where policy could result that would frankly stop climate change, because that tells you where I come down on the issue.
Subtle.
Not very subtle, but there it is.
So it's very difficult. I mean, let's just all recognize that that these are generally people with very different value systems, very different worldviews, very different perspectives and politics on the issue. That said, for all the challenges that are in trying to get that conversation done, I want to use a concrete example of where that actually can work. So in the state of Georgia, there's primarily a central utility that dominates most of the electricity market in the state. It's called Georgia Power. Mm-hmm. They had set up the system in such a way that homeowners who put solar panels on their roof were not allowed to sell their electricity that they produced themselves back into the grid. This is predominantly a monopoly. You know, that's a good business to be in. No competition. And so they had set up the system that way. So in Georgia, the Sierra Club partnered with the Atlanta Tea Party. So let me say that again.
Yeah, go ahead. Sierra
Club.
Because I thought I misheard you.
Yeah, the Sierra Club partnered with the Tea Party, one of the original Tea Parties.
Yeah.
Okay. To fight that regulation, and
really?
They did, and they. Fought them twice, and they won both times, and now homeowners in Georgia can put solar panels on their roof and sell that electricity into the grid. So why did they do this? Okay, Sierra Club, I think we all understand. They're a bunch of greenies. They care about the environment and so on and so forth. We know why they did it. It was climate change.
Yeah.
Tea Party doesn't even believe in climate change. So why would they do it? because this policy aligns with their underlying values, which are about individual liberty, individual freedom, individual autonomy, okay? And usually a deep suspicion of government and big companies telling you what you can and cannot do, okay? Their ideology is often about anti-government. So for the Tea Party, this was about who is this company or this government to tell me what I can do with my castle, okay? This is my home. I want to be independent and self-reliant, okay? I want to be able to produce my own electricity if I want to. So here's a policy, rooftop solar, where both the environmental left, the Sierra Club, could find common cause with the political right, meaning the Tea Party, in that both could see that this policy satisfied their underlying values. And that is the art of politics, is that how do you find policy solutions that completely different groups can come to endorse and support, albeit for completely different reasons?
So that was the common ground
there. That was the common ground.
And this seems to be an inspirational model.
It was, and in fact, they went on to find other places. I mean, they didn't agree about lots of other stuff, let's
be fair. Of course,
and
they never will.
Right, but they did find other things that they can continue to work on, and they're now actually affectionately called, wait for it, the Green Tea Party.
Wow, okay?
Really?
They actually went on in this last election to join up with other groups in Florida, because in Florida there was a proposed constitutional amendment put forward by the state utilities that was dressed up to look like a pro-solar amendment, but in fact actually would have blocked all future, again, individual homeowners from being able to put solar panels on the roof. This same set of folks, as well aligned with the Christian Coalition, fought those utilities and beat them at the polls.
Wow.
So this is starting to happen across the country where, again, very different types of people that you would never expect to even be in the same room, let alone pushing in the same direction, can at times work together.
Well, so one of the critical insights from your work and from others is that if you want to effectively communicate with an audience, you need to know your audience, you need to know what they value. Is it naive to think that there's ever going to be a grand agreement, grand compromise on climate science, climate policy in the United States? A decade ago, there was a bill passed in the House, seemed to be making traction in the Senate, and then it disappeared, collapsed. Is it going to be the small bore kind of things that you're talking about with local coalitions coming together, or is there still possibility of some big, broad national consensus on climate science?
So I think it's absolutely possible. I mean, we've seen that same thing actually happen in other countries such as the United Kingdom, where the Conservatives actually came to power in part because they promised to be more aggressive on climate change than Labour, which is, of course, their version of the Democratic Party. So no, it's certainly possible. I think, first of all, we have to recognize there is no silver bullet here. This is a problem that requires action by individuals, by families, by neighborhoods, by cities, by states, by the nation, and by the world as a whole, by companies, and all of us. So, I mean, this is a all-hands-on-deck kind of a challenge. That said, we are beginning to see conservatives coming to this issue, and let me rephrase that, coming back to this issue, because just to make a point, in 2008, the Republican nominee for President of the United States was Senator John McCain, conservative Republican from Arizona, who for years had been the sole champion of climate action in the U.S. Senate. Okay, now we're seeing, and then there was a big drop where basically the Tea Party arose and others that basically disputed the basic science of climate change. That is beginning to shift again, and we're seeing lots of really interesting signs. For instance, there was a new partnership formed with really important people in the Republican Party. James Baker, former Secretary of State for Ronald Reagan, George Shultz, Hank Paulson, former Treasury Secretary for George W. Bush, and others, who basically crafted their own conservative-based plan to deal with climate change, and that is to put a price on carbon, to make it an absolutely level playing field for all forms of energy, and then let them compete. So rather than regulating through, say, the EPA or the Interior or the federal agencies, saying, let's just put a single price on carbon to internalized to bring in all those costs that the burning of fossil fuels caused on our health, on our national security, and so on and so forth, and bring that into the price of the product. So we actually have to see and pay that cost, because right now the fossil fuel companies and we, when we emit these pollutants, we as a society ultimately pick them up in the form of allergies,
right,
and asthma and, you know, storm damage and all of that. We as the taxpayer end up paying that. So if you can get those costs into the price of carbon itself, of coal, oil, and natural gas, suddenly it's a level playing field and all forms of energy can compete. So that's a conservative idea.
Yeah. We got to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, produced each week by an amazing team of professionals at Rhode Island PBS. An audio version of this program can be heard four times each weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States channel, the POTUS channel, 124. I'm Jim Lutis, Executive Director of the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. And if you want, you can follow me on Twitter at J.M. Lutis. Alongside me, as always, is G. Wayne Miller, an accomplished journalist with the Providence Journal. And you can follow Wayne at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Anthony Leiserwitz, director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. And you can tweet him at Ecotone2, Ecotone, the number two. So, Tony, I want to ask you, so you made reference to this. There, through the first decade of this century, there was a steady increase in the number of people in the public who accepted climate science and thought that the United States should do something.
Yes.
It peaks 2007, maybe early 2008, mm-hmm. and then it drops substantially at the start of the Obama administration.
That's right.
The perhaps conspiratorially minded in me always dismissed that as, well, now that you had a Democratic president and a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate, the forces aligned against it came to bear to oppose climate science, and it suppressed those numbers. Is that fair? Is that accurate? What was really happening there?
So I think that's part of what's happening, of course, because in 2009, the Democrats proposed a cap-and-trade system, which, by the way, was a conservative strategy. It was actually invented in the Reagan administration and applied by the first George Bush senior presidency to solve the issue of acid rain. So Democrats thought, well, because we want to address climate change, let's use this Republican proven policy and apply it to this problem, because that way Republicans will support it. That's not the way it worked out.
It's a lot like the healthcare debate.
Well, in this case, Republicans demonized their own best ideas. And, you know, cap and trade, as we know, did not pass, and it became quite demonized on the right. But what we saw in that critical time period as well was this Tea Party revolt against the Obama administration. And that really changed the larger dynamic, because what we've seen in our research and others is that political elites, in other words, elected officials, can have a really big impact on their own party followers. Because again, most people don't know that much about this issue. And if you're a political partisan, you look to your elected officials to help guide you about this issue and lots of other issues. And at the time, you know, John McCain, after that election, and because of the rise of the Tea Party, he goes very quiet about climate change. Lindsey Graham, who totally knows what climate change is and why it's important, goes completely quiet, as do many, many other members of Congress. And why? Is because they were suddenly afraid of being primaried in 2010 and 2012. This is where those political dynamics can really shape the larger public discourse around this particular issue.
So here we are in the spring of 2017.
Yeah.
Give us a read on the president and the Republican controlled Congress. I mean, the alarmed, the 18%, would look and say, it's over, got to do something, or it's over. And the dismissive might say, right on. So we certainly have a Congress and we have a president who have not put it mildly, environmental issues at the top of the agenda.
Yeah.
Where do we stand? Where do we go from here?
So my crystal ball is cloudy, but I think it's fair to say that we're seeing the Republican Party as a whole beginning, if you'll excuse the pun, warm to the issue of global warming.
It's a good pun, actually. Yeah. I like puns, so you get an A for the pun.
Thank you. I mean, we've seen in just the past few years more and more Republicans beginning to poke their head out of the foxhole where they've been hiding for the past few years and beginning to take this issue on. And that really started in 2014, the midterms, when you may remember this, that a number of people running for Congress suddenly started saying, when they were challenged on global warming, they didn't say it's a hoax or it's not real or it's a liberal plot. They suddenly switched to this new talking point of, I'm not a scientist. Okay. Now, that's kind of ridiculous on the face of it, right? I mean, they're not doctors, but they do health policy, and they're not economists, but they do national economic policy, and there's thousands of scientists across the country who'd be more than happy to sit down with them and talk to them about the climate science. But that's not the point. It was a political talking point that got them out of the trouble they were in 2014. And why were they starting to feel the weight? It's because Democrats were beginning to use climate change as part of a larger narrative they were building about Republicans, which is that Republicans, and this is Democratic language, are so out of touch with reality that they don't even accept the conclusions of the world scientific community, climate change being an example. That began to draw some political blood. And so you saw some members of Congress running in 2014 now adopting this new phrase. Now we come forward to 2016, and what we've seen is that, for instance, there's a new caucus on climate change in the House of Representatives with 19 members of the Republican Party and 19 members of the Democratic Party. So these are people, Republicans now, who are willing to say, this is a real problem and we want to engage with it. And one of the ones who's most recently joined that caucus that I find fascinating is a member of Congress, Daryl Issa, from Southern California, who for years was one of the leading voices against climate science and against climate change. But suddenly he's joined this. Now, you know, I don't know what's inside his heart or inside his mind. I mean, maybe he finally read the reports and he talked to scientists and he made a rational, conclusion that this is really a serious problem. Coincidentally, he just won his last election by just a few thousand votes, okay? So it's possible that he's doing this as a political calculus, that he's seeing that the tide is changing in his own district, among his own constituents, and that it's now time to take this issue on. That's really the question. What happens to the larger political dynamic in this hard to predict situation we're in with the Trump administration?
You know, I'm curious, are American politics an outlier compared to most of the rest of the industrialized world when it comes to the issue of climate and climate policy?
So for years we partnered with the Gallup World Poll and we studied this in about 120, 130 countries around the world. And what I can say is that really the United States and three other countries are complete outliers, and where there's an organized resistance movement, essentially, against climate change. Those countries are the United States, Canada, Australia, and the UK. Okay. Now, what's interesting about all of those, they're all English-speaking. Okay. And it's easy for those who are professional climate deniers to talk to each other, to import and export their ideas, and to go have conferences with each other and so on. But you do not see this kind of organized resistance movement in China, in India, in most of Europe, in most of Central and South America.
China's recently said that they're really looking to take the leadership in terms of enforcing international climate standards and the Paris Accords.
That's right. I mean, China has many reasons to get engaged with this issue, not least of which that you're talking about a country that's, 1.3 billion people living on and trying to survive on a third of the farmland that we have in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay, this is real.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's what's really shifted in the Chinese mind. We've actually done studies in China and as well, is that for a long time they saw it as an international problem, a foreign affairs problem. But now they see that they're incredibly vulnerable to these impacts. And yet, they also see that the primary solution is this world-changing historic transition that we are in the middle of right now. It's one of the biggest stories in human history, and that is the transition from the fossil fuel age, where we dig stuff up out of the ground and set it on fire for our electricity, to the clean energy age, okay, where you basically just harvest the inexhaustible free energy that comes from the sun or blows across the land or comes from the tides and the waves, okay? That's the transition that's happening, and it is going to make the phone and the computer, I mean, these are tiny little industries compared to the amount of money that somebody is going to make. And the Chinese are not stupid.
Yeah.
They want to own as much of that market as possible.
So once again, it's the story of the power of technology to change culture and societies, the newer technologies that are coming online now.
Well, I mean, technology is clearly going to play an incredibly important role.
I'm talking about solar technology, wind technology.
Definitely.
You know, I live in a neighborhood now where we remark on the fact that, oh, my God, solar panels on more and more houses.
Yeah.
I mean, they're almost, exaggerating a bit, almost popping up like mushrooms.
That's right.
We've looked into it ourselves, and we're very close to going that route. Mm. Yeah. Part of it is for economic sense. Part of it is for, you know, our beliefs in green science and in green living. But it just makes sense.
There's also been good, important economic policy, government policy that has made it incentivized consumers to support that kind of behavior.
Yeah.
We've got about 2.5 minutes left, but I want to make sure that I ask you about Climate Connections, your radio program. Tell us what it is.
So about 3 years ago, we started a national radio program called Yale Climate Connections. It currently plays on 306 stations across the country, and these are 90-second stories. We didn't want to do a half-hour program that only plays at 11 o'clock at night on Saturdays that nobody would listen to. We wanted to make these 90 seconds, and it's a new story every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Wow.
And the point is really that second word, connections. Because, again, we know from our research that many people think if this issue is real, it's distant, and it's abstract, and it's global. It doesn't seem to connect to our lives, and it doesn't connect to our values. So what we've tried to do with this program is to find and tell the stories and hear the voices of people across America who are actually experiencing these impacts right here, right now. The rancher who's had to slaughter his herd because he no longer has enough food or water to keep them alive. You know, the homeowner who's facing sea level rise right in their backyard, and so on and so forth. But just as important, in fact, more important, are the stories of people who are taking action in their own lives to actually address this issue, ranging from the big ones like, you know, Microsoft or Google who are going 100% clean energy, to individual restaurateurs or mayors or a farmer who's doing what they can to be part of the solution. And I'll just say personally, having been in this field for 25 years, these stories are incredibly inspirational.
So,
I mean, they're so hopeful.
So how can our viewers and listeners find this program? It sounds great.
So it's playing on many stations across the country. It's also available through iTunes as a podcast and through a website called YaleClimateConnections.org.
Yeah.
And you can find all of our stories there.
Super. Yale Climate Connections, he's Tony Leiserowitz. Thank you so much for being with us. It's the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. We're out of time for this week, but if you want to know more about Storing the Public Square, you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter or visit PellCenter.org. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutest, asking you to join us again next week for more Storing the Public Square.